Hello, and welcome to Distillations, weekly extracts from the past, present, and future of chemistry. I'm Robert Hicks. Each week, we bring you stories on all things chemical, from lasers to lecterns. In this week's show, we'll explore chemistry in the classroom. We'll look at an element that's the basis for many student experiments, and visit a Drexel University classroom where the virtual world meets reality. All this and more on today's episode of Distillations. Many experts today say that American science education is in crisis. Recent surveys conducted by the National Science Foundation, or NSF, show that only about half of all Americans know that electrons are smaller than atoms, or that the Earth goes around the sun. But in fact, American science education has been said to be in crisis for most of the past century. Nearly 100 years ago, the progressive reformer John Dewey emphasized learning by doing. After Sputnik in 1957, the NSF poured money into curriculum programs based on critical inquiry instead of rote laboratory exercises. It's fair to ask whether these, or other reforms, have done much to increase scientific literacy. And today, in the face of growing economic competition from across the globe, Americans are once again asking how much and what kind of science students should learn. For some insights on these issues, we turn to Tom Tritton, the new president and CEO of the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Tom has had a long career as both a cancer researcher and a college administrator, including 10 years as the president of Haverford College. Tom, thanks very much for joining us on Distillations.
Thanks, Robert. It's really nice to be here.
My first question for you is, how do we place chemistry within the liberal arts?
Very interesting question, because I don't think there's one answer to that. The traditional liberal arts do not include chemistry. In modern society, all liberal arts programs have chemistry in all of the sciences as central to the study of the liberal arts. Students might choose to study chemistry, they might choose to study physics, they might choose biology, but they will ordinarily have to choose something, even if they're not going to be chemistry or science majors.
Why should non-science majors learn about science?
You could ask the same question about any subject, couldn't you? Why should people have to learn about anything? The answer is because the world is really interesting, and all the parts of the world are interconnected. So even if you're going to be a French major or study politics or anything at all, you're still going to encounter questions in our society that have to do with technical and scientific matters.
What do you think are the best techniques for teaching science to non-science majors?
Trick is to grab their attention, to make science really interesting, because it isn't to them. That's why they're not science majors. And the way you do that, I think, is to make it about the stories of the people, because people's lives are interesting no matter what their lives were dedicated to, and you make science relevant to their lives. So it's not just about the discoveries or memorizing Boyle's Law, PV equals NRT, I think that's right. It's about the implications of that. What does that mean in your life? If anything, because if it doesn't mean anything, if you're not interested in science, you won't remember that. But if you can connect it to something like blowing up a balloon, for example, then suddenly you might click and connect to someone who's not a science type of person.
We are, of course, in a presidential race. If you had to ask the candidates to address a science education issue, what would it be?
I would ask them, if you asked me as a scientist my advice, and it didn't agree with your predilection going in, would you take my advice seriously? That doesn't mean that you have to do it, but it means that you had to take it seriously, because I'm not going to give you my advice if I don't think you're going to take it seriously. And I think what's happened in contemporary public life is many scientists feel like they work very hard to develop thorough and dedicated and comprehensive analysis, and then no one pays any attention to it. It's not that they don't do it, it's that they don't even give it a chance to be thought about.
As campus president, you had to wear a toga for official functions. Does wearing a toga make one a better science educator?
Absolutely.
Tom, thank you very much for appearing today on Distillations.
Thank you, Robert. Last time I saw you was at a History of Science meeting in Cambridge. It's nice to see you here.
Tom Tritton is president and CEO of the Chemical Heritage Foundation. While ideas about how science should be taught frequently change, in chemistry, at least, there's always a constant. The teaching of chemistry, particularly physical chemistry, is largely based on models. From the ideal gas law to quantum mechanics, students learn to explore the physical world through equations and formulas that, to varying degrees, are abstractions of what actually takes place at the molecular level. In today's Element of the Week, CHF's Audra Wolf explains how most of these models are based on what we know about hydrogen.
Consisting of only a single proton and a single electron, hydrogen is one of nature's simplest forms. It is thought to have been the first element to form in the seconds after the Big Bang, and it's abundant throughout the universe. The sun, for example, is made up of about 90% hydrogen and 9% helium. Whether today's students realize it or not, what we know about hydrogen deeply informs what's taught in today's science classrooms. Let's consider the ideal gas law. As every high school chemistry student learns, PV equals NRT. Now, this is just a mathematical way of saying that if you have a given quantity of an ideal gas, pressure and volume are directly proportional to temperature. In other words, if you were to heat up 1 liter of hydrogen gas, it will either take up more space or the pressure will increase. But the devil's in the details. When we refer to an ideal gas, we're assuming that the molecules are so small relative to the spaces between them that they occupy virtually no space themselves. For a tiny molecule, like hydrogen gas, the assumption is close enough to reality that the predictions based on the ideal gas law will come very close to actual experimental values. But if we were to take a much larger atom, like radon, with an atomic weight of 222, we would see a bigger difference between experimental and predicted values. This happens because individual radon atoms have such a large volume that the assumptions of the ideal gas law are less valid. Still, hydrogen makes a good starting point for learning the basic laws of gas behavior. Countless other examples, from atomic spectra to nuclear fusion, are primarily based on what we know about hydrogen. Hydrogen may have a simple structure, but it has a long legacy. I'm Audra Wolf with the Element of the Week.
Have comments or questions about something you've heard on our show? Send your thoughts to distillations@chemheritage.org. You're listening to Distillations. I'm Robert Hicks. Many students of chemistry learned about atoms and bonds from ball and stick models. But elaborate molecules can often get unwieldy, not unlike the famous photo of James Watson and Francis Crick with the DNA model. Today, though, some chemistry teachers are using the online environment, Second Life, in order to create virtual online models of molecules that students can walk around and see for themselves. Cyrus Farivar reports from Second Life.
Drexel University chemistry professor Jean-Claude Bradley teaches far differently than most of his colleagues. Instead of lectures, he offers up podcasts, accompanied by a series of in-person workshops. As a supplement to the class, he's created a virtual classroom in Second Life, a three-dimensional online world where avatars, or personalized online characters, interact with each other in nearly every way imaginable. Professor Bradley takes me on a tour. That wind sound you hear is Second Life's version of a background breeze.
Well, right now we're in Drexel Islands, and we're on the shape of the island is in the form of a dragon. That's our mascot. And we're at the head of the dragon right now, where I teach my organic chemistry class.
While my avatar is a somewhat conservative but classy bearded man in a suit, Professor Bradley is, well, non-human. He's a cat. A purple cat.
I've tried various avatars, and I seem to feel most comfortable with this particular one. And that's sort of the fun of Second Life, is you can get to experiment with you know, different life forms.
Experimentation is what chemistry is all about, right? So I followed the purple cat along a grass-textured path to a molecular model overlooking a virtual sea. The model looks like an ordinary wooden ball-and-stick version, but in Second Life, it's twice my size.
Well, this is a molecule that we've made in my lab. It's potentially an anti-malarial agent. That's the research that I do in my lab. And this molecule, if you can actually walk around it, and it gives you a different way of, you know, perceiving chemistry than the traditional paper format or image format. It's a full three-dimensional object.
A short walk away, or a short flight if you prefer. Yes, you can fly in Second Life. We encounter a series of small blue obelisks. Professor Bradley shows me that if you click on one of the obelisks, it reveals four panels of molecule diagrams. It's a little quiz. The goal is to choose the correct panel as quickly as possible. One of his students from last semester, Chaz Cineri, a second-year biology major, says that the Second Life environment is a good secondary learning tool.
It just reinforces the material that you learn in class. So, I mean, organic chemistry is, you know, basically reactions and stuff like that. So, I mean, that's easily visual. So I find that easy using Second Life.
Saneri adds that he'd like to see more of his classes at Drexel, including math and biology, incorporate Second Life into the curriculum. Professor Bradley, for his part, is trying to entice more of his chemistry colleagues into using the online world. Organizations like San Francisco's Exploratorium and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention already have a presence in Second Life. Let's just hope not all of them are staffed by purple cats. For Distillations, I'm Cyrus Farivar.
Cyrus Farivar is a freelance technology journalist based in Oakland, California. For a screenshot of Drexel Island on Second Life, visit distillations.chemheritage.org. And that's it for this week's episode of Distillations. Today's quotation comes from literary critic John Mason Brown. Part of the American myth is that people who are handed the skin of a dead sheep at graduating time think that it will keep their minds alive forever. Distillations is a presentation of the Chemical Heritage Foundation and is made possible by the generous support of the Richard Lounsbery Foundation. Mia Lobel is our senior producer. Our assistant producer is Victoria Indeviro, and our executive producer is Audra Wolf. Our theme music is composed and performed by Dave Kaufman. Additional music provided by Andrew Chalfin and from the PodSafe Music Network. Check it out at music.podshow.com. Again, you can learn more about our show at distillations.chemheritage.org. Until next time, I'm Robert Hicks.